Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Adrian Wu, a research assistant at GTI.
And today we're so excited to be joined by Jonas Perello-Plesner, the executive director of the Alliance of Democracies Foundation. In addition to his work at the Alliance, he also serves as a senior advisor at Rasmussen Global, a political advisory firm based in Copenhagen. At the Alliance, he works with government, civil society groups, and other stakeholders to strengthen democratic systems and increase resilience against authoritarian threats. He's an expert on Chinese, European, and U.S. foreign policy, and his book, China's Strong Arm, Protecting Citizens and Assets Abroad, co-authored with Matthew Duchatel, was published in 2015. Well, Jonas, I'm so glad you could join us at what is really an interesting time for you, your organization, and Taiwan. In the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, countries around the world have really been forced to reckon with the fact that major war is not a thing of the past. This has been particularly pronounced in Europe, where states really on the front line of the conflict have become increasingly aware of the very real threat posed to democratic states by authoritarian powers. Given its position as a liberal democracy living in the shadow of a far stronger authoritarian China, Taiwan has really been increasingly discussed as a possible future target. In light of these concerns, we're so excited to have you here to discuss your work with Taiwan, the implications for Taiwan of the war in Ukraine, and Taiwan's potential role in a future democratic collaboration. Well, to begin, I'd love to start off on a bit of a personal note. Just a few weeks ago, you returned to Europe after spending several months in Taiwan, where you wrote a really informative and entertaining series of newsletters detailing your experiences, which we'll be sure to link in the description below. Can you talk a little bit about your trip? What led you to travel to Taiwan? And did the visit have any influence on sort of your broader thinking about Taiwan?
No, thanks, Marshall, and thanks for those kind words about the LinkedIn sort of series of newsletter that I did from Taiwan. And delighted that you're reading along. So, I mean, I went because I was for a short while visiting scholar at the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. The Taiwan Foundation for Democracy is one of our partners with the Alliance of Democracies. We have a cooperation with them about the yearly Copenhagen Democracy Summit, which is sort of our flagship activity here in the Alliance. So that's a little bit sort of the background. And then I think on a personal note, what led to was, of course, like many of us, the war in Ukraine, which led to a little bit of a reassessment that great power war and a sort of destructive war as well, which doesn't economically and in many other ways make sense, is possible. And that, of course, puts Taiwan as well into, even though they've lived for decades under sort of threat, and including military from China, you, of course, certainly ask the question once again, even more, could this happen? So I went out there with that basic question, has the Ukraine war kind of changed Taiwan's calculus, and what does it do for their efforts to do resilience in all the different ways, both digital, military, of course, but also on the civilian. So I, for example, went and joined the civilian defense initiatives and so how that worked out. I also met with, you could say, in the sharp edge of things with Taiwanese Ukraine fighters, Taiwanese that have gone to Ukraine and fought in Ukraine, and interviewed them about their experiences and how they see that. Mostly young men that had actually never been to Europe, but still saw that sort of fight for freedom as one that they were a part of.
Well, Jonas, I want to talk a little bit more about your time in Taiwan, and specifically one of the really major events that occurred during it was that Alliance of Democracies chairman Anders Fogh Rasmussen also made the trip to Taipei, where he expressed support for Taiwan and personally invited President Tsai to the Copenhagen Democracy Summit. From your perspective being there, what was the significance of Prime Minister Rasmussen's visit, and how does Taiwan fit in the Alliance of Democracies' broader goals?
No, thank you. Good question. I mean, actually, I think we should maybe add a title to for Rasmussen, which makes it even more sort of pertinent of why he went to. He's also the former Secretary General of NATO. So he was the one that preceded the current holder, Jens Stoltenberg, in that job. So this is also the first time that you'd had any former NATO Secretary General visit Taiwan. So I think it was just as much also with that sort of lens on it. And why did we do it? Well, that's back to sort of the strong cooperation that we've had as a foundation with Taiwan since 2019. And I think since our purpose with the Alliance of Democracies Foundation is to strengthen the cooperation among democracies of the world, we find it really important that Taiwan, which we see as part and parcel of the democratic family, they're also included. So it's basically in a way to sort of make sure that we include Taiwan's voice in these gatherings. And also more generally, I mean, during COVID, we also did a lot of webinars with Taiwanese digital minister, with other voices from Taiwan. So for Rasmussen, together with me, we met with the president, Tsai Ing-wen, with the vice president, foreign minister, but also with democracy activists and others from civil society while in Taiwan. So it was basically a way, and I think personally for Rasmussen, the fact that he hadn't been there for 29 years, meaning that last he was there was just at the beginning of the democratization, and now he came back and Taiwan has had several really successful and competitive presidential elections and parliamentary elections as well, and have moved up to become what he called it several times under during the visit as a beacon of liberty. So I think that was what was important for him also personally to experience that firsthand, and also to come out with, I would say, some of the warnings from relevant from Europe that we have seen how an authoritarian power, Russia, is willing to attack its smaller neighbor, Ukraine, and how we should all be part of securing Taiwan from a similar fate.
Yeah, so I mean, you're just mentioning about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and during his remarks, Rasmussen explicitly linked the situation in the Taiwan Strait to the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. Is this a comparison being drawn by other European leaders? How has the invasion influenced European thinking on Taiwan?
Oh, really good question. I think this is percolating, so he's definitely not the only one. The months I was there also, because they coincided with Taiwan kind of opening up in October, and many delegations, including from Europe, really wanted to visit, and that sort of, so you saw quite a number of particularly parliamentary delegations from different countries that visited Taiwan. And definitely there you hear echoes of some of the same, of saying, well, suddenly war is a possibility in a completely different way, and Russia has sort of broken to China, so to speak, so that this could happen as well in East Asia. So yes, I think you see that. How much then, which might be our next question and discussion, is how much people in Europe then really react to that and say, are we willing then to make a stronger deterrent? Are we willing to put forward already a message to China about stronger sanctions in case that we didn't have, I guess, is the conclusion with Russia, that we, from 2014, when we saw their aggressive intent, that we didn't deter them enough with a mix of military deterrence and a mix of economic deterrence as well. So I think that's maybe the open question about European engagement is, yes, a lot of people see Taiwan, they see Taiwan in a new light, they also see Taiwan as an important democracy. But from there to maybe changing policy, which of course is quite constricted and restricted because of the One China policy, which put sort of some more restraint on the sort of the exchange with Taiwan.
Before we move on to that greater perspective of Europe, just wanted to also focus in on more of an individual perspective, because during your time in Taiwan, you also had the amazing opportunity to interview Taiwanese citizens who traveled to Ukraine and fight against the Russian invasion. So can you talk a little bit more about what sorts of insights you gained from those conversations?
Yeah, no, thanks for highlighting. I mean, I think it started with me tracking Jonathan Singh, who is a young Taiwanese who died the 2nd of November in Ukraine fighting, and I followed his funeral when his family came back with his remains to Taiwan, and there was both a press conference actually out in the airport and a funeral down in Hualien, his sort of hometown. And that led me to sort of wanted to understand that him better, and then also some of the others that had gone but had survived and came back alive. And I got to talk to the two, Jack and Tony, both their English names, and who had had period in Ukraine. And I think that sort of completely gives a new perspective on things we are talking about. Theoretically, they both had that sort of urging that, well, Ukraine's fight is our fight. If their democracy and free society doesn't prevail in this fight, this will be a very sort of ominous sign for Taiwan. And therefore they went. Again, both of them, neither of them had been to Europe. In Tony's case, he actually doesn't really speak a lot of English. So he sort of managed and said kind of quite sweetly, because I asked how was that actually working out also in when he was in an army unit and when he was doing relief help. And he said, well, if you're there to support and so on, then that's the language that people understand. So I think both of them had some quite strong personal stories also of their encounters for the first time with Ukrainians. They went to Poland, got in over the land border, and then sort of signed up with the international volunteers or legion in Ukraine, and both were at different areas of the front. One at Izium, that was Tony, and I now blank exactly where Jack was, but somewhere else. He was actually, interestingly enough, embedded in the military unit together with Georgians from Georgia, the country. And suddenly he knew a lot about the whole 2008 war when Russia attacked Georgia, and in that sense had become really well-versed in European history of saying this was actually when it started and when we should already have stopped Putin, not something I think is part of the history education in a normal high school in Taiwan. So on a personal level, this was, I think, some really interesting perspectives, because this was also so direct. They've basically been willing to pay in the last resort the ultimate price with their own life for trying to defend Ukraine. And one of their compatriots, as I mentioned, did that and did pay the ultimate price with his own life. So for me, as part of the research trip to Taiwan, I think this was definitely something that personally kind of marked me of meeting these young men.
Well, Jonas, that's great. I'm glad you brought up that Prime Minister Rasmussen is the former Secretary General of NATO. NATO is playing a bigger role in these discussions around Taiwan than really ever before. After years of not really discussing Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait, the alliance is really showing increased interest in the Strait and affairs around Taiwan in recent months, with the alliance holding its first dedicated discussions on China's threat to Taiwan late last year. I'm curious to hear, from your perspective, is there a role that NATO could play in deterring a Chinese invasion? And are there any opportunities that you see for increased Taiwanese engagement with the alliance?
Well, that's a good question as well. I think definitely you see that. And the current holder of the office, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General, has said so, and also said so just recently at the Munich Security Conference, that there are clear parallels and we need to sort of make sure that China knows there are consequences for breaking the international order and attacking Taiwan. I also think there's a number of more, you could say, mundane or smaller elements where NATO now also wants to maybe increase cooperation with Taiwan. I think it's on cyber, where we saw massive Chinese cyber attacks following Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in August. It's on Chinese misinformation, where Taiwan is often the ground zero for this, in the same way as Ukraine is the ground zero for Russian misinformation and disinformation. So I think in these areas, there's an interest from NATO side of engaging. If we go to the bigger kind of military question, I think I would probably put more credence, and we can discuss that more, on EU and potential economic sanctions, which of course is not something that NATO sort of deals with. I do think that Taiwan Strait might still be a little bit out of area if you're talking about NATO being directly engaged. I mean, what would more likely, and of course these are the worst case scenarios that none of us want to see happen, but if we were to see China attack Taiwan, it would probably likely implicate, of course, a US defense of Taiwan. And then I think you would see NATO, that all the European operations would have to pivot to the Europeans. So you might see a huge, quick sort of burden sharing. And if this was still in a time where there's still war in Ukraine, it would be something that would be really tough for the Europeans, where the US is still, when it comes to the military support, providing a lion's share of it. So in that sense, I think there is a direct link also with NATO, that in any Taiwan contingency scenario where you would have the US move forces to the East Asian region, you would need Europeans to step up considerably in Europe, in and around Europe, in the Mediterranean as well. So I think that might still be the more realistic kind of burden sharing. Also, because if you look at the European countries, it would only be a couple of the bigger ones, France, UK, that would be even be capable of fielding naval assets in the area. I've actually myself been in 2018 on a sort of freedom of navigation operation with the French Navy that does operate in the South China Sea and to a lesser degree near the Taiwan Strait. So, but it's only those two powers that would even be sort of remotely relevant for direct support of the US and or Taiwan.
Well, Jonas, I'm glad you bring up the role of the European Union in this discussion around Taiwan and China. You know, while it's certainly true that Europe is a long way from the Taiwan Strait, and there's likely only so much that the EU could do, you know, militarily to help out in the event of a Taiwan Strait contingency, it's been really interesting to watch the European Union and its member states really show more interest in this. There's been so much more talk of Taiwan, more publications, more language and official documents mentioning Taiwan. I'd be interested to hear, you know, what's the significance of this increased interest in Taiwan? You know, what sorts of things can European states do to help Taiwan in the international system?
Well, I do think, personally, what I think we should do more is, one, increase the exchanges with Taiwan and therefore include Taiwan much more as a sort of equal part of the democratic family. So that's gathering like ours, conferences and so on, and have exchanges in a lot of areas where Taiwan is really relevant. That comes from, you know, their really exciting work when you look at their digital minister, Audrey Tang, what they do on Chinese disinformation. So I think there's quite a lot of areas where Europe should expand cooperation. Then secondly, I think after what we've seen in Ukraine and with Russia's war of aggression, we should be much clearer, including on the possible economic sanctions of saying what we, to the Chinese, of what you saw in the case of Russia, where companies have left en masse and where you've also seen economic sanctions. That's the same we would be willing to do in a case where China suddenly attacks Taiwan. And I actually also think we should already now kind of link it on this sort of sanctions of saying, because it's China at the moment that's continually changing the military status quo in the Taiwan Strait by flying or sailing closer and closer to Taiwan. So there should also maybe be some kind of menu of sanctions where we say, if you keep disturbing the status quo, which is what we as Europeans and Americans as well want to see in the Taiwan Strait, then we will also have economic sanctions that can sort of push back on that. So you're actually earlier, because you already see China using what can be called a bit the salami tactic of all the time kind of moving, cutting a little bit closer, getting a little bit, using new ways, both military, economic coercion on Taiwan, and always testing, does this one sort of go? And it's, we look back on Russia, it's a lot the same, that they tried it out, Putin in Georgia in 2008 and 2014 with Crimea, and saying, okay, if we just take a small bite, will people react? And you could see similar things with Taiwan, whether China was going to actually take a, maybe, you know, an island, one of the close islands to China, and see, okay, will it actually lead to a real kind of American and willingness among Europeans to sanction us? Or will people be like, oh, okay, a bit like Crimea, where there were sanctions, but they were relatively toothless, I think we all realize in hindsight, and we, particularly the Germans that continued at that time building the energy infrastructure with the Russians, kind of showed that business was kind of as usual. So I think it's important that the EU shows China that it's not business as usual on that front. So I think those are some of the things that I would like to see the EU do more. And then, of course, coordinate with democratic allies in the first and foremost Taiwan itself, but also the US, Japan, other neighbors, even further afield like Australia.
I'm really glad you brought up economic sanctions against China, because that is so important. And I think this also connects to something that you published before in Wall Street Journal in 2021, when you argued for the creation of an economic Article 5 to deter China from engaging in economic coercion against democracies. Could you explain what you mean by this? In the 2 years that have passed since you wrote the article, have you changed your thinking on it?
No, yeah, thanks. Good question. And it's always nice when people redrop it, even the older ones. Yeah, so that was sparked originally at that time by Australia. That was put under this sort of economic coercion by China for what was their big crime. They asked for independent inquiry into the origins of COVID in China, which is still something I think a lot of us would like. And China on its side sort of drew up a laundry list of 14 items, including a way too free press that was critical of China that Australia should address in order to repair relations. And meanwhile, they also did economic sanctions on Australian barley, Australian wine, and a couple of other products, and thereby cutting them out of the Chinese market, which of course is a very large and very enticing market. So China basically uses this market access as a way, an economic tool, but combines it with political ambition of getting other countries to basically do as they say. And well, and since it's actually just gotten worse, because the example since is that Lithuania opened a Taiwan a representative office in Vilnius in 2021 at the end of the year. I was actually in Vilnius in conjunction with that. And that led the Chinese to basically delete in the strongest move Lithuania from its customs book, and even try to sort of hurt Lithuanian trade through third country suppliers. But it's on the positive and flip side, it's led to that concepts like the Article 5 that I sort of kickstarted and have worked on with Anders Fogh Rasmussen since. In that article, that they have become much more mainstream. So we basically see the EU has now a bill that will come into legislation into effect at some point on precisely economic coercion and how to address it sort of jointly. And in Lithuania's case, at the WTO, the World Trade Organization, case was also brought forward, which was supported by both the whole of the EU, but also I think most of the members of the G7. So we definitely see embryonic attempts at what I really want is to see an alliance of democracies say, hey, and in particular to China, you should stop this. And so in the best case, you would have a deterrent effect by saying we stand in solidarity, which was the idea of the Article 5 sort of taken from NATO's military application of that, of saying, could you transfer that element of deterrence and that element of solidarity to the economic realm? And last but not least, you've seen the economic coercion also while I was in Taiwan. So while I was there, China banned several Taiwanese goods, including Taiwan beer, Kavalan whiskey, and some other products. And often they also do that kind of relatively targeted to try to hit, for example, with pineapples is probably the best example of that. That it's a farming area in the south of the island where most people vote for the DPP, the more sort of independent seeking of the two main Taiwanese parties. And therefore trying to kind of hurt their voters so that they feel, okay, their interests are actually not really taken care of by the now governing party, the DPP. So China also uses it in that regard. But yes, we still need to come up with, so it's still kind of relevant in the sense that we don't have a sort of coordinated tool among democracies to counter this. There is definitely, again, an increasing willingness. So you're also seeing G7 sort of speak out on China's economic coercion. But it's still not there that we have the tool. So in that sense, my argument for such an anti-coercion tool still stands.
Well, you know, it is really fascinating. It's been really interesting to watch the sort of development of the anti-coercion instrument and the development of these sort of broader conversations around dealing with China economically in these coercive measures. I want to close on a bit of a broader note and sort of look to the future a bit. You know, I think a big theme of this conversation has been the sort of rising interest and rising awareness of these issues in the Taiwan Strait, China's threat to Taiwan more specifically. Curious to hear, now that you're back in Europe, now that you're engaging with partners across Europe, are you optimistic or pessimistic about Taiwan's place in the international system? You know, what do you think is going to happen in terms of support for Taiwan going forward?
Yeah, I am optimistic. I mean, I'm also realistic at the same time. So, I mean, I'm optimistic because Taiwan has managed on its own, even with all this amount of pressure, to transform their society into one that's a really high-class democracy. So, I mean, we've had, if you look at Freedom House numbers, we have 16 years of straight declines in democracy, including many of our own in Europe, be it Hungary as an example. And meanwhile, you've had Taiwan have sort of skyrocketed up to become, at least if you look at the Economist index, to become among sort of the top 10 democracies in the world, and a bit lower in some of the other rankings. So I think that makes you optimistic. And then seeing Taiwan's sort of vibrant civil society, that also in this case now with the threat from China, you don't just have to sort of the military changes with Tsai Ing-wen, who announced a longer military conscription and increases in defense budget. You also have a lot of civilian defense initiatives, which I went to as part of when I was out there, something called both Kuma Academy, but also the Forward Alliance and other initiatives where people train, basic first aid, train what to put in your rescue / refugee backpack if you have to, because Taiwan doesn't have, that's a big difference from Ukraine, where Ukrainian refugees have been able to then get relocated in other friendly neighboring countries. Taiwan is an island and doesn't have that opportunity, meaning that people would be internally displaced in case of a conflict. So they kind of train for that and uses that sort of civic activism to sort of garner the will and the resilience to protect their own societies. All of that made me optimistic. I mean, then the realism part is, of course, the fact that we live in a world where autocracies, particularly Russia and China, increasingly want to redefine the world, including with military means. And that is, of course, a big challenge kind of for all of us. And of course, not the world I or anybody else kind of dreamt about, but one where the world was much more safe for democracy, including in Taiwan.
Well, Jonas, I think that's a great place to close. You know, I know this has been a very wide-ranging conversation, talking about the EU, NATO, you know, all sorts of factors here that really do play a role. But I think you've done a really good job of linking them all together. You know, I think, like you, we're optimistic too. We're excited to see what happens next, and we're excited to see all this extra support for Taiwan. But as the war in Ukraine has made abundantly clear, you know, war is not off the table. This is still a very scary time for democracies around the world, and specifically for Taiwan. But I think you've done a great job of providing that sort of necessary context. So, Jonas, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Marshall. Thank you, Adrian. This has been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, our frequent public seminars, and our other podcasts. You can listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights. Thank you.